Hi guys, Barry here. Guess what? You made it to the end of 2020. Oh, sweet mother of God, what a year. Let's not beat around the bush, guys. It's been a period of 365 days. Oh no, God, it was a leap year. It was even one day longer. Well, suffice to say, most of us will be glad to see the back of the past year. But we here at Worse for Forward still have a lot to be thankful for. Ben and I have put together this best of episode to celebrate some of the best moments of the past 12 months, because with everything else that was going on, we still managed to squeeze in north of 65 hours worth of recording, we reckon, something like that. We've managed to whittle that down to just over an hour's worth of material featuring some of our favourite moments from the past year, and we're hoping that the year ahead will feature many more just like them, and including more live shows. We did our first live show this year. We did our first live stream. Ben had a new baby. I decided I could lose, you know, part of a vital bodily organ. It's been a hell of a time. However the past 12 months have been for you and yours, we hope that the next 12 months will provide better things, and that the following hour or so will show you that, hey, 2020 wasn't all bad. We learnt a lot about the ghosts of frozen chickens, that gays and lesbians can be a force to be reckoned with in the geopolitical sphere, that even flat earthers need round the world cruises, and that sometimes people who win the Great British Bake Off have cannibalistic tendencies. All that and more coming up, and a quick thank you to everyone who's appeared on the show this year, and particularly those who you're about to hear. In order of appearance, they are Joseph Cullen, Terry Victor, Vicky Pipe, David Atherton, Bethany Black, Dr. Lucy Rogers, Jack Blackburn, James Shakeshaft, Delia Shand, Ola the Comedian, Ashraf Edgebear, Lucy Jane Atkinson, Dom Nichols, Seb Falk, Eleanor Morton, Mufseen Mia, Katie Shoot, Steve Cross, Nick Pettigrew, Lee Kyle, Susan E. Connolly, Juliet Myers, and Dr. Anna Porshaisky, Rowan McCluskey, and Joel Morris, and our live audience at the Vault Festival 2020. Thanks to everyone who's been on the show. Thanks to all of you for listening. We hope we see you in 2021. Then again, there's a couple of days left in 2020. I reckon, asteroid to the middle of the face. Nice knowing you all.
So, first of all, we go to Utah State University, who've been doing some rather odd genetic engineering, because the milk produced by goats there contains something very special. What do you think the goat milk contains?
I've read this. It's bonkers.
I haven't read this. What does the goat milk contain?
The hot new game show coming to Channel 5.
I mean, it's going to be something like semen, isn't it?
Firstly...
Oh, that's not my choice. That's not what I choose. That's not what I...
No, it's not what you choose, but let's just think about that. I mean, I know that anything is possible with genetic engineering, but, like, male semen is ending up in female goat milk.
Let's be fair to Joe. It's no less bonkers than the actual answer.
The actual answer is super strong spider silk.
Oh.
Spider goats, spider goats.
Spider goats. farming spiders in large quantities has always been challenging. Because obviously, you know, you've got to sort out the paddocks, and like, how do you do a cattle grid for something that's got eight legs? Really tricky. Researchers have essentially altered the DNA and modified it along with the gene of a golden orb spider. And after the goats are milked, the spider silk protein is extracted and used to make things like incredibly tough body armor, fishing lines, or artificial ligaments and tendons, which is incredibly cool. But why isn't other science that mad?
Because obviously, you know, New York has Spider-Man. Utah, much more rural state, and they have spider goat. But I like to imagine that, take it a step further, and you have a man being bitten by a radioactive spider goat who then is Spider Goat Man, who has the combined abilities of both a spider and a ghost. So it can swing from webs between cities, between city buildings, but also might be able to take down, you know, a troll under a bridge.
Not only can he climb walls, he can also climb really rocky mountains.
Yeah. Oh my god, the Marvel movie, he's definitely, his real identity is he's a nanny.
Yes! Amazing!
That's so good, isn't it?
Francis Gross.
Oh, I've heard of him.
Have heard of Francis Gross, the Classical Dictionary of the Vulgar Tongue.
Oh, that's him, yeah. Which seems appropriate for someone with the surname Gross.
I mean, it's spelled S-E at the end, but he was as wide as he was tall, pretty much. And he used to hang around these low dives around Seven Dials in London and places like that, you know, mixing with the worst of the worst in order to collect their language. His stuff changed the world. And he came up with, found words like be twattled.
Does
be surprised.
I'm
utterly be twattled. He defined a word spelt C-T as a nasty word for a nasty thing. but my favourite, and I mentioned it earlier, my favourite word is nincompoop. And this again is from Francis Gross. And it's a man who has never seen his wife's private parts.
Oh, wow. That's bitchy, isn't it?
Also, it had a bit more sort of like frigidness to it.
It had a bit of edge to it, certainly when he collected the word. I mean, now it's just a fool, isn't it?
Yeah.
If it's even used at all. But it has that real nasty edge to it that makes it interesting language because it's quite specific.
Yeah. And I love the notion of him just hanging out in these dens full of gamblers and prostitutes and thieves, and they're all having a great time, and someone goes, who's that in the corner? I don't worry, that's just Frankie. He's just writing down everything we say.
Yeah.
Exactly. I mean, there's a thing where he was seeking out roisterers and ne'er-do-wells, the card sharps, cup pursers, highwaymen and lowlifers of Hogarthian London.
Ah.
Such a picture. And there's this wide bloke, short, wide, not healthy, living off their language and adoring it and sharing it. He and a guy called Tom Cocking, who was his sidekick.
No.
Hello, Cocking and Gross. How can we serve your lexicographical needs?
Without them, we wouldn't have words like fartleberries. Don't knock it. These guys, they changed the way we see the language because they facilitated it moving on. When I was working on the big dictionary of unconventional English, I went to a prison to some of the prisoners and said, you know, what's the latest slang going on, blah. And they didn't want to tell me a word until I said, oh, it's going to be about 3 years till the book comes out. Oh, that's all right. Now let's tell you about this one. Because it's such a fluid way the language moves on. So at that particular point in the 18th century, when Francis Gross was working, that's when those words had vibrancy in life.
Mm.
I don't know, there is a magic to it. When I said his wife's private parts, he would have also called them his Madge,
yeah,
which is quite nice in context, or her doodle sack.
I'm a big fan of the word growler for female genitalia. It really pleases
great
me.
Word, yes. Alas, it's the one word you can guarantee will make Giles Brandreth giggle.
Yes, I'll bet.
It was also a carriage in the time of, of Sherlock Holmes, wasn't it? I'm just going to mount this growler.
We talked about the Rainhill trials.
Oh,
which
yes.
was the trials for the early steam locomotive. Who would get the contract, basically, to be one of the first public railroads, mm-hmm. won by Stephenson's Rocket.
Mm-hmm.
And the Rainhill trials took place on October 1829. And I'm more interested in one of the other entrants in the competition. Most of the competitors were basically steam-powered in various forms. But my favourite is the cycloped. Do you know what the cycloped is, Vicky?
The name is a little bit of a giveaway.
Yeah.
Is it powered by human legs?
Even better.
Can I just say that you made that sound as creepy as possible? I could make a train powered by human legs.
Oh, you're not imagining her chopping legs off and chucking them into a furnace. I was imagining a Flintstone-style situation.
I'm imagining her dressed like the Fat Controller in that Thomas the Tank Engine paper I showed you earlier.
Holding up legs.
Yeah.
No, the cycloped was built by Thomas Shaw Brandreth of Liverpool. and was powered by horse.
Oh.
Not pulling it.
Yeah, yeah.
Not pulling it.
Oh, what?
Inside it.
What? Like in a giant horse hamster wheel?
It was on a treadmill that was kept moving by the horse mounted on top of it. Inside, and I am delighted to be able to show you both
the
blueprint.
Is this where horsepower comes? No, I know it doesn't, but like
horsepower. No, it can't be.
Here is the blueprint.
Whoa. Oh, the poor horse. Horse.
It's one horse, of course.
I'm a little angry that there's not a jockey on there.
There was some controversy, not about the horse being inside the train.
About the cruelty to the animal.
No, about the fact that Brandreth was one of the directors of the railway for which they were competing for the rights to be the train running on it. But of course, it wasn't able to equal the speed achieved by the steam-powered ones, and the cycloped lost the competition. The Rocket won the trials, maintaining an average speed of 13.8 miles per hour. Yeah, so the horse was on a drive belt, and its top speed was 5 miles an hour compared to the 13.8 of Rocket. Some suggest it's not even a serious attempt because it wasn't steam powered. It probably didn't really meet the criteria they were looking for in the first place.
But the director's like, yeah, I could do this.
Yeah. As Steve pointed out, one of the steam locomotives dropped out because it exploded. Cycloped was the first one to drop out of the competition.
Because one of the horses exploded?
Apparently because the horse fell through the floor of the engine.
Do you know what? That's my biggest regret to do with food, is when I lived in Papua New Guinea, I was offered human flesh because they still eat it in Papua. They don't kill for it, so it's not... it's illegal to kill someone and then eat it.
So people leave their bodies to restaurants?
Yeah, not to restaurants.
Donating my body to culinary arts.
No, it's part of the funeral, like part of the thing, like it's the biggest respect if your body is able to live on through your friends and family by people having a piece of you. But there's so many things that...
Do you want a piece of me?
Literally, yes.
Thanks, Grandpa.
But depending on how you died and like... if you had a disease and all this, there's lots of rules in different parts of the body. But
yeah, what if you die of skin cancer? I'm out.
No.
Yeah. I'll peel you first.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, there's nothing more embarrassing than when you're chowing down on a bit of grandma and they're like, you've not taken the skin off.
This one's a bit wrinkly.
It's meant to be like that. It's a delicacy.
I'm so sorry to our listeners of Papua New Guinea because we do have someone for being completely disrespectful to your funeral rites.
Do we have listeners from Papua New Guinea?
Apparently, we had 3 last month.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Okay, if you're a listener in Papua New Guinea, firstly, as Barry said, sorry.
Secondly, do you like breast or thighs?
How close do you come to eating some?
Not very close. I was a lot younger than now. No, I'll put anything in my mouth.
It would, good lord. It's always difficult when you get to that part of the funeral in Papua New Guinea when you go, right, so, who's going to carve?
Obviously, if it was a Christian service, you'd go to the communion and be body of Christ, body of your aunt.
Yeah. I think different bits of the human would taste well, because I think if I was going to eat human, I'd want pulled human. I'd want slow cooked.
You're such a hipster.
Do you know what? The testicles are really nice.
I can imagine.
Well, they're not goat's testicles are the ones I eat, but they're really nice. You don't need to slow cook those; they're quick cook.
Yeah,
they're really soft.
If you were going to consume another human being, who would you eat?
I think I'd pick Zac Efron.
I think there'd be too many additives.
I think he's not particularly hairy. I think he looks after himself, so like the meat will be good. He's not
a bit too
skinny.
Tough, though. Yeah. You want someone that's got muscle, but they don't use it very often.
Okay, yeah.
So kind of like a surfer who's just like naturally born. Like people from California who've got those good genetics.
Yeah, or an ex-athlete. Colin Jackson. Oh. I'll go Colin Jackson.
Oh, yeah. Hurdlers are a bit stringy.
I'm literally turning into a Sweeney Todd song.
Yeah. I would... Oh, gosh, who would I eat? Because you've both gone for sort of like lithe. I want someone who's just like...
A bit more fast?
Well, no, I want someone with a dad bod, you know, so it's marbled, you know, a little bit.
Wagyu.
The Wagyu, yeah. Who is the Wagyu of the world today? Who's like that Hollywood Wagyu?
Well, he's a bit old now, but like a Robbie Coltrane, you know?
He's beyond Wagyu.
Well, he's beyond Wagyu, you know, but also what you imagine that'll be kind of like, it'll be corn-fed and, you know, flavoured with whiskey.
Do you want...
Or like, I don't know, Billy Connolly jerky.
Would you have like a free-range Robbie Coltrane or like a battery Robbie Coltrane?
I really like smoked food, so I might go for a darts player.
Oh, nice.
Because then you've got the sizing. Maybe not cigarette smoke, but
I do
like
the alcohol to it. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. What was the guy, the Viking? What was he called?
Oh, yeah.
I know what you mean.
Andy Fordham. Oh, yeah, but then he lost all his weight, so.
Yeah, he didn't. No, that wouldn't be nice. And I don't know, Raymond van Barneveld?
Yeah.
I just feel he'd be, like, very, very buttery.
And please visit Worst Foot Forward on Twitter to send us your own suggestions of what celebrity you would eat.
Please do.
Well, at Worst Foot. And please make sure to tag David and his agents in it. Yeah.
But my choice for the world's worst race is this particular race that Pat Boyd took part in. Pat Boyd was this isn't the Tour de France itself, but it is a cycle race in Belgium. Pat Boyd was a famous English cyclist in the 50s, and during a race in Belgium, his bike was so battered by the cobbled streets that he got a puncture and he had to repair it, and that left him right at the back, seemingly out of the race. And he pushed and pushed and just tried to catch up, finally catching up with a lone rider. And the cyclist was a local, he was from the area, wasn't able to keep up with the peloton, so he was like, well, I know the route, let's go together. They rode together, became friends, and the rider, knowing Boyd was considered a favourite, he recognised Boyd as a famous cyclist. He said he knows a shortcut down an alleyway that would allow him to catch up with the race. And I'm now quoting from a book called Cycling Strangest Tales. Pat's new pal indicated an unassuming little alleyway, intimating that the secret shortcut was their only hope. The pair pedalled furiously down the passage. When they emerged at the other end of the alley, the peloton was suddenly and tantalisingly within sight. Pat was in business. He caught the leaders and remained in the pack for the rest of the race to register the top 10 finish he craved. Great ending, right?
Yep.
This local rider had been taking part in a different race that was happening in the same town at the same time. The race organisers, when they heard what had happened, registered Boyd as a finisher in the race, but placed him last because he'd never actually started the race. Not only that, he also finished last in the race that he was actually trying to take part in.
Back to 2014, the French train operator SNCF bought 2,000 new trains. They cost 15 billion euros. And they got them, they put them in, and then they realised that they wouldn't fit in over 1,000 of the platforms in France.
Oh my God.
The trains were too fat.
They couldn't fit wideways as opposed to lengthways.
Wideways.
Oh,
wideways.
Wow.
They smashed into the platform as they came into the station.
Forget the fat controller, they had fat Thomas the Tank Engines.
Yep.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
And that is, of course, where Kevin Eldon got the idea for his show, Big Train.
Did they return them? Did they rebuild the platforms?
50 million euros it cost to fix all the platforms. And they had to just change the platforms because there were too many trains.
Oh, my God.
Now, the reason for this is because the train operator and the rail operator, so that the people who owned the tracks and the people who owned the trains were different. And the rail operator was RFF. And so the train operator said, how big are your platforms? And so RFF said, oh, well, the ones we've built in the last 30 years are so wide. But they didn't mention that the ones built over 30 years ago were wider. We discovered this problem a little late.
I feel like inbuilt obsolescence isn't really useful when it comes to public infrastructure.
Because, all the trains were slimmer 50 years ago.
And what was the NASA one?
Mars Climate Orbiter.
This
was back in 1998 it was launched. And this was going to go to Mars, a spacecraft going to go to Mars, was going to orbit Mars and bring back all great scientific information. So it got there, everything was going fine, and then it crashed into Mars. And it was meant to go, you know, into orbit, go round and round.
Right.
And the reason for this was because one of the suppliers giving the information was working in Imperial, in miles.
No.
And the other was working in kilometres.
Oh, God. It's the Spinal Tap incident at NASA.
My world's was parliamentarian. I'm going to go back to the Georgian era and talk about John Mad Jack Mitten.
And that name inspires so much confidence in the electorate.
Yeah, yes. I'm not sure that it was written on the voting slip. His family were Shropshire squires with a lineage going back some 500 years in the area. And when his father died at the age of 30, Jack was just 2 years old, and he inherited the family seat of Holston Hall near Oswestry. And that was worth more than 60 grand at the time, £4.3 million as of 2006. He was sent to Westminster School, but expelled after 1 year because he fought with a master. He was then sent to Harrow, from which he was also expelled after 3 terms. He was then educated by a variety of private tutors who he would torment with practical jokes, such as leaving a horse in one of the tutors' bedrooms.
The full horse, not he didn't go mafia style, just the head, the whole thing.
No. Just of all, how he got them up the staircase, who knows, unless he used a hoist to get it in via the window. He was granted entry to Trinity College, Cambridge in 1816, and he allegedly took with him 2,000 bottles of port to sustain himself.
Is that just for the first year or for the full undergrad? Yeah.
That was just for Freshers Week.
Yeah.
He was not awarded a degree, and after university life, he embarked on a grand tour of Europe. He entered the army. You'll be unsurprised to know he fell into disrepute through gambling. He indulged particularly in a love of horse racing and gambling, and in 1825 he bought a horse named Euphrates and entered it into the Gold Cup at Lichfield in 1825, which it won. Well done, Mad Jack. A year later, in order to win a bet, he rode a horse, I don't know if it was Euphrates or not, into the Bedford Hotel opposite the Town Hall in Leamington Spa, up the grand staircase, onto the balcony, from which he jumped, still seated on the horse, over the diners in the restaurant below, and then out through the window onto the parade.
Did he have a thing where he thought all bedrooms were stables?
Clearly he'd heard about Empress Catherine the Great and thought, that's how you woo ladies. I'm going to tell you a few more horse stories. He loved hunting foxes. Obviously he had his own pack of hounds. In fact, he had 2,000 dogs, which he kept.
One for each bottle of port, that's nice.
Precisely. Well, no, he fed them all steak and champagne.
Oh no, wow.
Yeah.
He had fat, drunk hunting hounds.
Farting along on champagne bubbles behind him. His own favourite horse, Baronet, had the free range of Holston Hall and would often lay in front of the fire with Mad Jack.
In its own bedroom.
In its own bedroom. When he went hunting for foxes, he would usually do it in just a light jacket, thin shoes, linen trousers and silk stockings, and the thrill of the chase filled him up with such joy, he would often strip off his clothes and end up hunting naked, even in winter time.
Please tell me how this fine upstanding gentleman ended up in Parliament then.
We're getting there. It seemed that he genuinely loved accidents. He would often drive his gig, which is like the little carriage behind horses, at high speeds over toll gates to deliberately crash. And at one time he was with a passenger and he said to him, "Have you ever been overturned in a gig?" And his passenger said, "I have not." "What? What a damn slow fellow you must have been all your life." And he promptly deliberately drove the gig up a sloping bank at full speed, tipping himself and his passenger out of it. My last story about him is that in the 1830s, he had to flee to Calais, obviously, with an attractive 20-year-old woman named Susan, to flee his debts. During his stay in Calais, he tried to cure his hiccups by setting his shirt on fire. a chronicler at this event, someone called Charles James Appleby, said that Mitten was said to exclaim, "Damn this hiccup," as he stood undressed on the floor. And in the act of getting into bed, he went, "I'll frighten it away." So he seized a lighted candle, applied it to the tail of his shirt, and was instantly enveloped in flames. And a fellow guest and Mitten's servant beat the flames out, and Mitten stood up and went, "The hiccup is gone, by God," and then got into bed naked and fell asleep.
This sounds very prescient of the UK government's response to coronavirus. Yeah. The smallest problem taken on with the most blunt instrument, and then whilst chaos reigns, just yeah, but at least the hiccup's gone. Like,
yeah.
So obviously, this man was a blazing drunk, braggart, gambler, hedonist. In 1819, he entertained ambitions of standing for Parliament as a Tory, following the family tradition. The way he secured his seat was by offering voters £10 notes.
Ah, oh, great.
He spent a total of £10,000, or £750,000 in modern money, and became the MP for Shrewsbury. How long do you think he spent in the House of Commons, gentlemen?
Well, it's either going to be very, very long, or is it likely that it was about a day because his dad died and he inherited a title and had to go to the House of Lords?
Oh, that's a good idea.
I would love it to be that procedural, though. He spent 30 minutes in the House of Commons, but said he found the debates boring and difficult.
There were no horses and alcohol.
Right?
For the bishop's caning, there was another thing that I read, and maybe this is more reflective on me than anything else. Other stories that are told about their village are that they have put manure around the church steeple to make it grow higher. But when the manure sort of dries out a bit and settles, it would have left a mark, and so there'd be like a couple of inches. It would look like the tower had grown by a couple of inches out of the manure. Which, you know, that's fair enough. If you don't know, if you weren't there to see the church being built, you might think that churches are naturally occurring.
Yeah. You think Donald Trump does that to all of his hotels that he lies about how tall they are?
Just covers them in manure.
Well, bullshit of some sort, yeah.
Please tell me someone has done an opera in Klingon.
Ha!
Welcome, my friend, to my suggestion.
Yes! Yes!
Yeah, just, you know, listeners, this is a tops-off moment for me and Barry. Now, I don't know how to pronounce this, obviously, but the opera is just called U, but it's like U with a glottal stop, so I think it's OO, or what? Yeah.
OO!
Yeah, there you go. Thanks. Yeah, it's got, you've got to sound like you've just had something inserted in yourself, yeah, against your consent. And it was first put on in Holland. I mean, how could the people tell the difference in the language? brilliantly, it was billed as the first authentic Klingon opera on Earth. Composed by Yves Van Breen, to a libretto by Kees Lightline and Mark Ockrand. And it was put on, the premiere of the opera was put on in The Hague on the 10th of September.
For war crimes, precisely.
Now, brilliantly, it's actually quite authentic, because in Star Trek lore, the Klingons are passionate opera lovers.
Are they really?
Oh, yeah, they are. Yeah.
So it sort of fits. And according to the webpage for the opera, Klingon opera uses the principle of musical combat. Beauty in Klingon music comes from the impact of two opposing forces, and the title of the opera translates to universe or universal.
This is like the Hay on Wye festival inviting people to do Vogon poetry. Just because they like it doesn't mean you should be doing it.
Yeah, just because people, the other thing, just because you could didn't mean that you should.
Yeah.
In the world of the philosopher Goldblum. And the whole story of it, I'm not going to take you through the story of it, but it's essentially a mixture of Klingon Romeo and Juliet and Klingon, what's the Greek myth of the guy who goes to the underworld to get his missus back?
Oh,
Orpheus.
Orpheus in the underworld, yeah, there's a lot of that in it. But to make it authentic, they based it on an ancient Klingon treatise called the Pak Chujachu, which I've said in a more South American accent, but it is, which translates as the Book of the Perfect Scream. And my favourite thing about it is that in 2010, before the opera, Ockrent, on behalf of the Klingon Terran Research Institute, which is a real thing, broadcast a message from a radio telescope to the hypothetical coordinates of the Klingon home planet, inviting them to attend the opera.
Wow.
God. Mm. And I hope they said they sent back a message going, new phone, who dis?
Yeah.
Plot of Living in Bondage should give you an idea of sort of the melodrama that exists within an awful lot of cinema. Oh man, hang on, I've realised I've just deleted it from my damn it.
Can you do Control Z?
Oh no, I haven't immediately deleted it.
I mean, googling the phrase living in bondage is a tricky thing.
That was a high risk manoeuvre. Yeah, the plot of Living in Bondage is pretty full on. So a chap called Ande Okeke and his wife Merit face pretty severe obstacles during their life. And despite the support and patience of his wife, this chap is driven to near depression and he's determined to achieve wealth by any means, including going to a satanic cult where members pledge their loyalty to Lucifer and kill their loved ones in ritualized sacrifices to gain enormous wealth in return. And it's all about evangelical Christians trying to rescue him from this money-hunting, Lucifer-worshipping cult. And to be honest, I'm absolutely in. That is...
I like the fact that it's as many Nollywood films as I discovered in two parts.
Can explain the two parts thing, and I just want to say that satanic cult thing is a running theme. There's like, I don't know if it's a genre or just like a prerequisite for a Nollywood film, but there is a lot to do with like cults, which is Nigeria is a very spiritual country. Like they see spiritual elements in almost everything they do. So even when Nigerians practice Christianity, it's highly spiritual. The culture and the understanding is that life is way more spiritual than we see. Now, the part one, part two thing. Nigerians at first, when like the technology came out so that, you know, stuff was being released on DVD, a lot of Nigerians didn't have DVD players. They had VCD players, right? You put the video on a CD, the same technology as an audio compact disc, but they could play videos. Uh-huh. And it was sort of like a step down technology from the DVD player. So they put out these VCDs, but because they're not a DVD, they don't hold as much, right?
Ah.
So you'd have to basically put out at least two to get the movie across. But what they started doing was they now started making it more of an opportunity for a cliffhanger. It's now started getting so ridiculous to the point where the first, you almost know that when you buy the first VCD, like nothing's going to happen.
Yeah. They have to wait
your time just to get you. And then right like in the last 10 to 15 minutes, they will get you so invested in the story that you have to go out and buy it because literally nothing has happened.
Yeah.
Like you've got to the point where you now know all the characters. They've made you watch so much. It's so many establishing shots. So like literally if someone's going to like get out of their room and go into the car, you'll watch every moment from them like putting the jacket on.
Yeah.
And they're fiddling with the zip. And then they're like looking for their keys. And then they're like opening the door. And you're like, these guys, they come again. And it just became part of the filmmaking style because that was what was making money. It was profitable to do it that way. And so literally you started to see movies kind of go to like part three, part four. And sometimes what they actually started doing was they started naming part three and part four a different name. So like, let's say Living in Bondage was in four parts. There'd be Living in Bondage 1, Living in Bondage Part 2. Then there'll be like Freedom from Chains Part 1, Freedom from Chains. So then you go and buy Freedom from Chains Part 1. You realize it's actually the sequel to Living in Bondage. So you now have to go back and buy Living in Bondage.
It's just like Star Wars that starts with Episode 4.
Yes. Exactly. Exactly.
And so much of Nollywood filmmaking, certainly up until the past couple of years, was done on a shoestring. So, you know, editors are very much far down the chain of what you can afford.
I did watch one, and the credits start with a thank you to all the people who've clearly let them use their houses and shops for free as shooting locations.
I'm really fascinated in how a style develops from the circumstances that it grows up in. You can definitely see product placement in a Nollywood film. Right? So if someone goes into a shop, I don't know whether they stipulate it in the contract or whatever it is, but not only will we see the name of the shop, we'll literally see this person browse through all of the goods and be like, excuse me, sir, how much is this phone? This phone right here is the latest phone, top phones we sell here at Ajimoshu's Phone Emporium. We sell the greatest phones starting from 10,000 naira up to 1 million naira. And it's like, come on, like, my guy, I get it. The guy let you use his shop, so now you have to promote his business. But does it have to be this on the nose? And that's the thing. There's no subtlety. It does have to be that on the nose.
The other thing that I love, and I think some sort of Bollywood movies share this as well, is the delightfully shonky special effects. In some of the remakes. And the best way I could describe it, if you've never watched it, most of the special effects look like they have been ripped and stolen from the original Mortal Kombat on the Super Nintendo.
Yeah! I always say it looks like the special effects are done on Microsoft PowerPoint.
Yeah.
Literally everything zooms in from left, zoom in from right, zoom from above. It's literally, you know, I think it's up for mockery because I very much enjoy doing that. But I think it's also something to be applauded because it's like, with such little resources, these guys put whatever, like literally what everyone's doing now on social media and, you know, like on TikTok, they'll give you a little effect and you try and make something funny out of it or interesting out of it. That's literally what they were doing with whatever effects they had at that time. Yeah. And this is before, like, everyone had a MacBook and a DSLR and could shoot at a certain quality. And so the fact that they were doing this much, to me, like, it puts it all in context.
I would like to have seen the low-budget Nollywood version of Game of Thrones where Emilia Clarke is acting opposite Clippy. It looks like you want to become the king.
Yeah.
Here's a question. Why, if we have life jackets on airplanes, why don't we have parachutes on boats?
Barry, some 1990s Seinfeld stand-up called and he wants his jokes back.
Oh, is that a Seinfeld line? This occurred to me.
No, it's not. It just feels so authentically like some brick wall observational stand-up.
Fine. How was the airline food while you were on the plane, by the way, Ashraf?
It was lovely. I love airplane food. I love a little metal box.
And impossible to spread butter.
Yes, and the whole jigsaw puzzle of, you know, okay, I'm going to unpack this and put this in there.
Yeah, it's like a little game of Tetris, how you arrange your tray.
Let me tell you about the worst vacation I could find. I tried to find all sorts of different organisations that might organise a jolly. And do you know who's probably organised definitely the stupidest vacation? It's our friends at the Flat Earth International Conference. Because last year they announced their biggest, boldest adventure, and it was this. It was a cruise to sail to the ends of the earth to come up to the enormous ice wall that they believe surrounds the flat earth and prevents any of the ocean water from falling off the sides.
And
I'm genuinely, like, obviously this is bonkers, but I'm also really glad to know that they think there's a wall around the earth, because that's a fact I didn't know. I mean, it's not a fact, but it's the thing I didn't know.
Because I thought that, you know, if you did believe that there was a gushing waterfall at the end, it would make sense that you would keep parachutes on your boat.
Yeah.
Oh, we're getting close to the edge. Everyone put your parachutes on.
You bringing up People Going Commando brings me to what I think is the worst fashion show ever, which is Rick Owens' Spring Summer 2015, or as it is popularly known, hashtag Dick Owens, where it was a menswear collection where the clothes had strategically placed peepholes, let one say.
I remember this.
Where, like, they were basically specifically built so that you could see all of the dicks. So all of the male models were walking down the catwalk, breezy and free.
I've just seen one.
Yeah. Oh yeah. There's some peen on show in this show. It was, I mean, the worst thing about it is the clothes are ugly. Things McQueen had done, even if there was nudity, the clothes were spectacular. With Rick Owens in 2015, the clothes were really ugly and were seemingly just built to show off some penises.
They look like they're wearing leather bin bags.
Yeah.
It's yes, kind of do. Like hair shirt chic.
Yeah.
Like they're all, you know, early hair shirt early Christian.
Was a member of the Gestapo.
Yeah. Hair shirt chic, yes. no, they all look like early Christian hermits who've yeah. just come out for a walk around.
It's
the thing I'm liking about it, because I'm clicking through several of these photos, the unfortunate thing is I don't know how cold the models are feeling or how poorly endowed some of them are. A lot of the holes aren't as effective as they should be. Yeah. They're just there, but actually there isn't that much penis.
Yeah, well, I think that's like, you know, sort of as they walk, you maybe catch a glimpse. It's,
yes,
you know, it's like the high fashion version of the can-can.
The way it's ending as well, like the choreography is awful as well. So it's ending with some sort of weird conga line where they're all getting together and acting in this absolutely demented way.
It's like Starlight Express of the dance.
The only reason that high fashion has kind of continued to exist in the way that it does is because no one feels safe to laugh at it.
Yeah.
And I think with this show in particular, like before the show had even ended, it had sparked a hashtag, you know, like there was no way of getting around how ridiculous it was. And Rick Owens was kind of talking about how female nudity is like relatively commonplace in high fashion. If you go to museums, then you see kind of these beautiful marble sculptures and, you know, the male nudity there is artistic.
And it's a fair point.
Which is a very fair point. The way he manifested that in his show was imprecise.
It is. And it's, and it's tricky because... How can I phrase this delicately? I'm not sure I can. Like, female nudity is better than male nudity. And I'm not just
I hate to disagree with you.
I'm not just saying that from a heterosexual point of view. I feel like talking not just even aesthetically, geometrically, the shapes that the female naked body give are better than the shapes the male naked body is. I mean, essentially what I'm saying is that I prefer spheres to cylinders.
I think that's a very biased viewpoint.
Yeah.
I can see what you mean.
I don't. Well, because let's face it as well, not of course that all breasts are uniform, or indeed that all vaginas are uniform, but I think they're better shapes than, because a dick isn't just like a cylinder and a couple of spheres hidden in a little scraggly bag.
God's first design.
It was.
Listen, to streamline these.
How can I put it? You might find penises appetizing, but I disagree with you if you find them aesthetically beautiful.
We can agree to disagree. But my choice for the world's worst weapon is the bat bomb.
Is this from the same guys?
No, this is from America. The Americans not happy with a few dead rats with explosives sewn inside them. They went a little bit further. They built a bomb-shaped casing with 1,000 compartments in it to contain hibernating Mexican free-tailed bats with tiny incendiary bombs attached to them.
I've said it before and I will say it again. I feel like in the 20th century, some of the greatest military minds descended into a psychological space most occupied by Wile E. Coyote.
Yeah, this is very much on that. They would drop this bomb at dawn. The casings would, they'd open a parachute, it would open up and the bats would be able to fly out. They'd disperse and roost in the eaves and attics within a 20 to 40 mile radius. The thinking being that eventually when the incendiary bombs went off, they would devastate the Japanese cities they were targeting, because a lot of them were made of wood and paper, of course. So, which obviously later on, firebombing was a major tactic the US used against the Japanese cities. But the idea behind it is absolutely, like, ridiculous. The bat bomb was invented or conceived by a dental surgeon from Irwin, Pennsylvania, named Little S. Adams, who was a friend of First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt.
Oh, God.
Basically, he'd been to a national park, he saw lots of bats roosting, and he sent her a letter going... And just shortly after the attack in Pearl Harbor, going, you know what would be a great idea? Would be if you tied bombs to bats.
Did it say that, or did it say...
he clearly had the ear of the First Lady, who of course had the ear of the President, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and he said, you know, this guy's not an idiot. He must know it. Let's devote some time and money to this. So he said,
I'm Roosevelt. It's the New Deal. We're throwing money at anything.
Yeah, literally anything. The idea, obviously, they then had to assemble a team to look into the project, decide on the type of incendiaries they'd attach. They had to decide, I love this sentence, they had to decide what species of bat to use. After testing several species, the Mexican freetail bat was, how did that testing process go? Do you imagine that audition process? It's not really like The Voice. Or something like that. Or, you know, that bat didn't blow up in quite the right way.
Will they have had to have erect sort of like fake Japanese villages and send bats off?
They literally did, Ben. Yes, they did.
Great military mind right here.
They carried out a test on a Japanese village, a mock-up of a Japanese city built in Utah. And carried out the definitive test after they picked the right bat. They had to ask for permission from the National Park Service to harvest large numbers of Mexican free-tailed bats.
To be fair, they probably found out about what the Soviets did with the dogs and like, right, we need to get a bat that's clever enough to know that it's in Japan rather than Utah.
Yes. They also had to figure out how to attach the incendiaries to the bats. They tried various different, you know, tying it on or strapping it on. Eventually, they just went with gluing them to the front of the bats.
They all glue again.
Yeah. It didn't quite make it. That test in Utah did go all right. But a couple of setbacks occurred. In one instance, the Carlsbad Army Air Base in New Mexico was set on fire when armed bats were accidentally released, roosted under a fuel tank and incinerated the test range. And it's thought that the development of the bat bomb was hampered a bit too slowly and eventually was overtaken in the race for the quick end to the war by the atomic bomb. Can you imagine the Cold War if this project had actually made it to fruition and it had ended World War II and said suddenly the Germans, the French, the Russians are all trying to build bat bombs instead of nukes?
Oh my God, so yeah, like a, what was it, a bat arms race?
Yeah, it's a wing race.
A wing race, of course.
Well, I brought you a map that is pretty well known, at least in kind of circles of people that are interested in maps, and it's the Hereford Mappamundi, which you might have heard of, at Hereford Cathedral, made around 1300, so the later Middle Ages, and it's about the size of a double bedsheet, so it's a pretty big map. It's about 5 feet square, and it is made of an entire calf skin. So they got a cow, they slaughtered it, they cut it down the belly, they opened it out,
and inside was a map of the world.
It's kind of the shape that you would expect. It's a little bit longer than it is wide. It's kind of got a neck to it. And then they sort of chopped off it's got corners more or less where the legs of the cow are. If you imagine getting a calf and kind of opening it out.
Yeah, spatchcocking a calf.
Exactly. Like I say, it's a square with the triangle on top. And at the very top of the apex of the triangle is Jesus Christ. Not on every map, but certainly on this one, and a few angels.
Here be dragons, here be messiahs.
There are dragons. It doesn't say here be dragons, but there are dragons on this map. Their dragons are on a little island. Well, actually, they're in a few places, but there's some really cute dragons on a little island in the Red Sea.
Oh, nice.
And then, of course, in the middle, for taking up almost all of the space of the calf skin, is this big circular map. Not a map of the entire world, it's really important to say, but a map of the inhabited world, a map of the world that was known to humans at that time. It's crap by our standards, because we have certain standards for what should be in a map and what shouldn't be in a map. But it actually does what it sets out to achieve pretty brilliantly. With a few exceptions, which I do have to tell you about, like the fact that they mislabeled Africa and Europe. So Africa is labeled Europe and Europe is labeled Africa.
Isn't that just foreshadowing colonialism by a few centuries?
Nobody has come up with a plausible explanation for how that might conceivably be deliberate. I think that's just a cock-up. But other things that we consider to be a bit silly are actually entirely part of the design of the map. And in a way, I think the best way to think about this map, it's more like one of those picture books that if you've got kids, you've got for your children. I've got one of these here, which is this kind of children's book of maps.
Yeah.
And if I turn to the page for the UK, I find that in the Scottish borders around about Gala Shields, there's a giant hedgehog.
Yeah.
And taking up the whole of Devon is a sort of cartoonish lopsided picture of King Arthur. And these maps, but the point of these maps, right, is to kind of evoke a place. The point about the Hereford Mapamundi is that it does a similar job, right? It's not a map of the world in the sense that it's just describing what is in each place. It's telling a story, and that story is the providential story of human history. It's creation. It's the stories from the Bible. And it's not just telling us where we've been, it's also telling us where we're going to go. So it's kind of a pictographic history rather than a description of what's in the world. But of course, that history is full of really awesome, exciting things. So on Crete, you've got the Minotaur. In near the Black Sea, you've got the Golden Fleece of Jason and the Argonauts. You've got all of the really important biblical stories. So right at the middle is Jerusalem. Jerusalem was at the middle of the world. East, by the way, is at the top. Christian maps tended to be east at the top. And the map is based on a really familiar old scheme. It's called the TO map. And the TO map basically is a T inside an O. So you've got a capital T inside a circle. And above the line of the T, which runs across the middle, is Asia. And the bottom left corner that's made by the vertical bit of the T is Europe, if you've labelled it correctly.
It's very hard to tipex a cow, though.
Yeah, you've got to wait for the milk to congeal enough so you can make tipex.
We don't know what draft this is. They might have gone through the entire herd and gone, fuck it. If the only mistake we have on this final draft is that we've mislabelled Africa and Europe, well, it'll have to do.
It was particularly young boys who did a lot of the accusations, and they were called in Swedish viskosar, which literally translates as singing boys, because they were sort of singing these tales. And it was claimed that they had a specific power to spot the stigma diaboli, the mark of the devil, on the forehead of witches. And they would basically stand outside church services and point and accuse women and name them guilty as like part of the carrying out of the service. And more often than not, these poor women were executed.
So if a kid calls you a witch, people are like, yeah, well, he seems to know what he's talking about. Yeah, he's got a nice singing voice.
Well, the grim thing was, it wasn't like the sweet angelic children of the well-to-do. It was often orphan children, beggars and street children, because they were like, well, we're getting paid for this. You get paid for identifying witches. They're like, this is a fucking great grift, lads.
Oh my God.
Oh, it's a great idea to pay people to give evidence, isn't it?
Yes.
That never corrupts anything.
Yeah, not at all. I want to read you a little bit about a description of what one of the boys said happened at Blackula. It's incredible in the detail. So they say, at Blackula, they partied like at a peasant wedding. They drank and ate and danced and had sex to the light that stuck in women's vaginas while the devil lay under the table, and laughter that the room thundered and hellfire lit it up.
I didn't know that Goop was operating in Sweden. 17th century.
You only have to pay a couple of $100 for something like that as well.
Yeah.
They danced with their backs to each other and did everything backwards to how they did it in real life. They married several people at the same time and had sex with Satan and the devils, whose penises were cold and whose semen was water.
And then they gave
birth. Entirely reasonable. I mean, from my point of view, if your semen was sparkling water, that's far worse. although it would tickle on the way out, wouldn't it?
I'm about to Perrier.
Yeah.
But I read a bit more about pride flags. In 1989, John Stout sued his landlords and won when they tried to stop him from displaying the flag on his apartment balcony in West Hollywood. For the 25th anniversary of Stonewall in 1994, Baker, the guy who created the flag, was commissioned to create the world's largest rainbow flag, a mile-long flag dubbed Raise the Rainbow. He's done that again. In 2003, he did a mile-and-a-half-long one.
mile long. I'm just trying to get my head around that.
Bit of a size queen when it comes to flags, Gilbert Baker. But in 2004, LGBT activists from Australia sailed to the Coral Sea Islands territory and raised the rainbow flag, proclaiming an independent territory of Australia, calling it the Gay and Lesbian Kingdom of the Coral Sea Islands.
Yes, please.
Yeah, the rainbow flag has been used as the state flag of the Gay and Lesbian Kingdom. They were protesting the Australian government's refusal to recognise same-sex marriages, particularly marriages conducted abroad, not recognising Australians who then came back to Australia who were same-sex as married. And this place, the territory of the Coral Sea Islands, is just east of the Great Barrier Reef. My favourite bit about it is I was reading about it and the Wikipedia article has a section headed Rise of the Gay and Lesbian Kingdom. So immediately I was hooked. During Brisbane Pride, they decided that the marriage law wasn't going to be changed. They were advocating for it. And so basically, based on the law of unjust enrichment, which says if something is unjustly taken, compensation must be made. And with reference to international law, which states oppressed peoples of overseas territories have the right to self-government and self-determination, the activists claimed territorial compensation, establishing an independent gay state. Sailing on the 14th of June 2004 on a ship named the Gay Flower.
I'm absolutely here for that.
To Cato Island, raising the rainbow flag and declaring it an independent gay and lesbian state. They placed a memorial plaque on the island saying, on the 14th day of June 2004, at this highest point in the Coral Sea, Emperor Dale Parker Anderson raised the gay rainbow flag and claimed the islands of the Coral Sea in his name as homeland for the gay and lesbian peoples of the world. God save our king. A, missing a chance to say God save our queen, but also he declared himself emperor at the start of this whole thing, so he's demoted himself by the sound of the end of it. They drafted a Declaration of Independence, which begins, homosexual people have honestly endeavoured everywhere to merge ourselves into the social life of surrounding communities and to be treated equally. We are not permitted to do so. In vain we are loyal patriots, our loyalty in some places running to extremes. In vain do we make the same sacrifices of life and property as our fellow citizens. In vain do we strive to increase the fame of our native land in science and art, or her wealth by trade and commerce. In countries where we have lived for centuries, we are still cried down as strangers. In the world as it is now, and for an indefinite period, I think we shall not be left in peace. Which is quite cool.
Yeah.
The activists founded a campsite on Cato Island, which they named Heaven, after the gay nightclub in London, which is the capital city. And the kingdom's national anthem is, of course, I Am What I Am. not only that, but in a scheme similar to the law of return in Israel, where you're automatically granted residency if you want to be as a Jew.
Yeah,
you're automatically
Aliyah. It is called
Aliyah. You're automatically and immediately eligible for citizenship in the Gay and Lesbian Kingdom of the Coral Sea Islands simply by being gay or lesbian. They issued their first stamps in July 2006. Their kingdom's website states that tourism, fishing, and stamp sales are its only economic activities. On the 13th of September 2004, the Gay Kingdom declared war on Australia.
Amazing.
Oh my God.
Amazing. I mean, guys, like, surely we all want them to be accepted into the Olympics, so hopefully someone can win an event and the pride flag can be raised whilst I Am What I Am is blasted out of the speakers of the stadium.
I bring you sad news. In February 2017, Senator Eric Abetz, who voted against marriage equality in Australia, he objected to the rainbow flag being displayed in the Department of Finance, saying, this particular flag is the flag of the Gay and Lesbian Kingdom of the Coral Sea Islands, which has declared war on Australia. It is the flag of a hostile nation, if we are to believe them.
I mean,
they shouldn't be flying the flag. Yeah,
he's a prick, but he's gone down the right channels there to make his point. See, the way I mean, obviously, I meant that vote was won, but just to make sure, they should have gone, hey, do you want to vote to abolish a gay kingdom in the Pacific? And then loads of bigots would have voted to get rid of that, and then you would have got an even more overwhelming victory.
Yeah.
You've probably heard of it. Hagfish. Have you heard of a hagfish?
Oh, yeah.
So it's basically like a... they also call it a slime eel, although it's not technically an eel. So first of all, the most horrifying thing about it, so not only is it just this big eel like creepy worm thing, It can secrete several buckets full of slime, like 5-gallon buckets of slime, out of its own throat combined with seawater as a defense mechanism.
Yeah.
So if you tried to eat a live hagfish, I don't know why you would, but it'll just vomit slime. That's its slime bag that you're looking at there. It can vomit out its own like slime secreting throat thing. So that it doesn't swallow its own slime.
So kids are really into making slime at the moment. So maybe the hagfish is 2020's hot new domestic pet.
Well, I'll give you some reasons to put them off.
Okay.
So that's the first thing. It's just horrifying. In fact, I saw a picture. I don't know if you can find it. I should have looked up. But there was a truck, for some reason, like, carrying some hagfish. Yeah, there it is. And it crashed, and there is like a whole road full of a slime slick.
It looks like King Kong has blown his load all over a family
car. It's like Ghostbusters 2 with a car. It's also, they have horrifying.
This. Is that the looking at the picture here, is that vagina dentata?
Yeah, they've got four rows of teeth, apparently, so that they can tear all the flesh up from their victims. And they attack live and carrion prey. But if that isn't enough, I'm already like, vagina dentata, slime creature, like all horrifying. But also, it can tie itself in a knot. And like crush stuff to death.
So not like boa constrictor style, but
not a knot, like an actual like.
Does it do like? Has it got badges from the scouts?
It makes tea for old ladies. Yeah.
Milk or slime?
Yeah.
Dip, blah blah blah. Surely it's got to do one of those like the slip knots where it's like a knot, but when you pull the other end, it just.
It's got a little book, and it's like, which one do you want?
Oh, it's like one of those magic tricks where, like, and you put it and the knot falls away.
Yeah.
You take a scissors and you cut it in half and it's still a whole hagfish.
No, that's a sponge you're thinking of.
Yeah.
And then there's the more Lovecraftian thing about it that's a bit more creepy. So all of that is just like, okay, that's horrible and that's nature and I get it and that's just gross. And please look them up because they're horrible.
Yeah, we'll put a picture on the Twitter wall.
Great. But also, they're sort of this indeterminate species. They're the only species scientists argue about whether they're a vertebrate or an invertebrate because they're sort of neither.
Because
they have a skull, but it's not made of bone. It's made of cartilage, is that right?
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Yeah, it doesn't have vertebrae as such. It doesn't have a jaw, but it does have teeth. So it's this weird thing, and it's one of the oldest species as well. So they found.
I was about to say, I bet it's hundreds of millions of years old, but it was going. Oh, we're just gonna try out this evolution thing.
The only known fossil hagfish from 300 million years ago looks very much like a modern hagfish, leading some scientists to speculate it's changed little since then. Quote: "It's an indication, not that they've stalemated and not evolving, but they've arrived at a body plan that is still very successful today."
No! That sounds...
How alien is that?
We have arrived at a body plan that is hugely successful even today.
It's just...
Even humans haven't arrived at a body plan that's hugely successful.
The
keto diet.
Yeah. The hagfish is there just going, "I am beach body ready."
The Ig Nobel Prizes.
Yeah!
We've talked about them a little bit. The Ig Nobels were created in 1991 by a guy called Mark Abrahams, who was the editor of and co-founder of a magazine, Annals of Improbable Research. And he's been the MC of the...
Please tell me that because it's the Ig Nobel Prize, that was spelt A-N-A-L-S.
No, I wish it wasn't. But this guy has been the MC at all the award ceremonies. And awards were presented at the time for discoveries that cannot or should not be reproduced. And so they hand out a lot of Nobel categories like physics and chemistry and medicine and literature and peace awards. But then they vary some of the other categories from year to year. So you might get an award in public health, engineering, biology, interdisciplinary research. And they do recognise genuine achievements, though they mix it with a healthy dose of satire in amongst it as well. And they even awarded 3 awards in the first year to fictitious scientists, which I think we've covered in previous shows. Most of the awards are presented by actual Nobel laureates.
And they have
And they have the ceremony in a lecture hall at MIT, originally in MIT, but now it's at Harvard. They have a lot of running jokes at the ceremony. And I think you mentioned this one before. They have Miss Sweetie Poo, an 8-year-old girl who they have a 1-minute time limit on your acceptance speech.
But rather than have an orchestra start playing to play you off like they would at the Oscars or like a Showbiz Awards ceremony, Miss Sweetie Poo, after a minute, just starts crying out, "Please stop, I'm bored."
I think every academic in the world needs this.
Yeah. Not only that, but they usually close the ceremony with the words, "If you didn't win a prize, and especially if you did, better luck next year." They also encourage people to throw paper airplanes onto the stage during the awards ceremony. And for many years, Professor Roy J. Glauber used to sweep the airplanes off the stage as the official keeper of the broom. Glauber wasn't able to attend the 2005 awards. Do you know why?
He was dead.
Nope. He was in Stockholm claiming a genuine Nobel Prize in Physics.
Oh my God, that's like winning an Oscar and a Razzie at the same time.
Well, Ben, let me tell you about Sir Andre Geim, who is the only person to date who has been awarded both an Ig Nobel Prize and a Nobel Prize. In 2000, he won an Ig Nobel Prize for levitating a frog using its own inherent magnetism. And you can see a photo of the frog looking very unimpressed if you want to...
What with Gonzo the Great in the background?
Either of you would absolutely love to be levitated using your own inherent magnetism.
Oh.
Just sit there thinking, a lucky frog.
Yeah.
He's got the story for the rest of the frogs when he goes back home. What have you been up to? Just eating flies. Really? I can fly.
And in 2010, Geim was awarded a Nobel Prize for Physics for his work on an old enemy of this show's graphene.
Oh!
For studying its electromagnetic properties.
My nomination is Richard Pockridge. Born in 1695 in Derriusk in Ireland. His dad died when Richard was 25. When you see the rest of his life, I think he died of embarrassment, to be honest with you. His dad died and he got an inheritance of about £4,000 a year, which I did like the calculator thing for inflation. And that's about £600,000 a year.
Ooh.
In today's money. And that's a really dangerous amount of money to have,
because yeah,
it's not small enough where you have to be careful and think and sort of just lead a normal life. But it's not big enough where you can just, fuck it, I'll buy a yacht, I don't care.
Yeah.
So he was said to be the inspiration for the floating islands of Laputa in Gulliver's Travels.
Okay.
Oh.
Which, I don't know if you've read Gulliver's Travels. It's the island where everybody has kind of weird invention ideas.
Mm.
His contemporaries called him a mixture of quixotic and an enterprising scoundrel.
I wouldn't mind that being on my gravestone.
His first enterprise was a brewery in Dublin. Yeah. In about 1715, and it failed. I don't want to sort of go into stereotypes. Selling beer in 1700s in Dublin, and you can't make that a success.
To be fair, he also proposed building it at Island Bridge, which is very close to the location of the actual now Guinness brewery. So,
so it's like building your own theme park next to Disneyland.
Yeah.
Apparently, when he had his brewery, he entered one of his beers into a competition, like the best beer. And he lost. So what he did was, to console himself, he sat and drank the entire barrel that he'd entered into the competition.
Good Lord. Next year he used, like, I'm going to enter this cheese competition and I either get to win or I'm going to have a lovely afternoon.
Yeah.
Let's crack on with the next one. Because his next idea was everybody in the country was going to have a pair of wings. He didn't appear to have invented a set of wings or have like a patent or anything like that. He just said, one day everybody will have a pair of wings.
Was it because he ran for Parliament a few times as well, didn't he? So he was it a campaign promise? A pair of wings in every household.
No, he actually said at one point in the future, it might be as common for men to call for their wings as they now call for their boots.
Oh, I like that. Marjorie, fetch my wings.
Did he have this idea just after he'd finished that entire barrel of beer at that competition? He did the glass organ as well. He invented one of those.
Possibly his only invention that kind of worked at all was that. He called it the angelic organ.
Angels, wings, that's where it's from. He loves
that's
them.
It's all going from, yeah. And he actually toured with it, he performed with it, and he was Richard Pockridge and his angelic organ.
Sexy.
Yeah, absolutely. His invention was a wine glass with some water in it.
Yeah.
And then a wet finger, and then around the top of the rim. So the angelic organ was a load of those in different pitches, just in a tray in front of him. So that was his invention, was glasses and water.
Yeah.
Well, he probably needs those after drinking the barrel full of booze.
To sober up a little bit.
Yeah.
So basically, that was it was the angelic organ. That was his thing. And he had a big performance set up in London that he was going to unveil this to, you know, the nation. But it was cancelled 3 hours before it was due to happen because, and so many performances are cancelled this way, because a runaway pig got into the theatre and knocked over all the glass.
It is just the Muppets now. It is just the Muppets.
Yeah. Who released the pig?
A rival.
Apparently he was tuning up and he went backstage for a breath of fresh air or a fag or whatever. And it being London in the 1700s, a pig walked past, got into the theatre and mayhem ensued.
Oh my God. I can see why you were putting him forward as the world's worst inventor.
But it's the fact that his musical instrument can be absolutely ruined by it being a bit warm.
Yeah.
Water just evaporates out of the glasses and out-tunes it, or you've got a cat and gets thirsty, or just a runaway pig. And that was his big thing. But there's a really nice story that when his brewery was going into liquidation, he had bailiffs come round to his house, and he distracted them by playing his angelic harp. And a bottle of wine as well. And he played the harp, and apparently they were so enchanted that they let him off with the debt.
Oh, nice.
But that was the one that kind of lived on. He had, his big thing was blood transfusions.
Yeah.
And he would transfer the blood into a wine glass and then lick his finger. And that would make the devil's harp.
Yes.
He was a proponent of blood transfusions. The first human-to-human blood transfusion was by Dr. Philip Fizik.
Ha!
Great.
Which is just on point. Yeah. But that was in 1795. Richard thought that if you transferred blood from young people to old people, it would make the old people young again.
Oh, no.
He tried to paint and being a vampire, basically.
Oh, Richard, you're so close to something actually, like, important. So close.
In his invention, he said, there will be a problem, not with morality of sucking the blood out of young people, but immortality. People could end up immortal.
That was the problem.
So basically what he said was, once somebody reaches the age of 999, they can be pronounced dead. So their will can be enacted, and the local vicar can get the burial fee that he's been denied.
I thought you were going to say the problem is when people become 999, their age is just going to roll over again to zero, and they're going to become a baby.
The Y1K bug, basically. In the end of his life, he said, well, what I want is for my body to be preserved in spirits so future generations can look at me and as an exhibit. But he died. He was burnt to a crisp in a coffee house.
Oh, no. Did he burn with sort of a light blue flame? The female hyena has a really enlarged clitoris. It's so big. It's about 6 or 7 inches. It's quite hard to distinguish it from the penis of the males. But it's a
Sorry,
really...
I'm really trying to be the big man there.
Yeah.
About 6 or 7 inches. But it's a really multi-purpose clitoris.
What, can you get stones out of horses' hooves with it as well?
It's a Swiss Army hyena clitoris. Because they use it for urination, for mating, and for giving birth.
So they give birth through the clitoris?
And the vaginal canal, of the which is in the clitoris, they travel down the vaginal canal, but they actually come out through the clitoris. And the gap in the tip of the clitoris is only about an inch in diameter. Yeah, so massively painful for the mother. And cubs can literally suffocate trying to get out through it when they're being born.
Not laughing now, are they?
Yeah, apparently, I read an article about this and they had like a little addendum saying from like a hyena expert.
Not
saying,
that little addendum, it's 6 or 7
This lady said that, yeah, it looks dumb evolutionary, but there must be an even worse alternative that this is replacing.
Yeah, just bursting out of their stomach.
Like an alien
style.
On Earth, yeah.
Oh no, I've given birth out of my flaps.
Yeah.
You've heard of Francis Bacon, haven't you guys?
Yes. Not the painter, the 16th century philosopher and so on.
He's the sort of seen as the godfather of empiricism.
I think he died because of a frozen chicken. Am I imagining that?
No, you are not imagining that. He was engaged in a robust debate with a gentleman called Dr. Witherbone, which I'd love to tell you that he was an expert in canine science, but sadly not. And they were talking about preservation and ways to preserve animals. And Bacon went to Highgate, where he got several chickens from different farms. He killed it, cleaned it, packed it with snow, and put it in a large sack with more snow around it to create the world's first frozen chicken. However, whilst doing all of this, Bacon caught a chill, which turned into pneumonia, and he passed away. However, it is not the ghost of Sir Francis Bacon that haunts Highgate. It's the ghost of the chicken that he killed.
Makes sense to me. Poor chicken sacrificed for science. You know, unfinished business.
Yeah.
You know?
Has someone just left a lot of corn lying around?
Yeah. Well, yeah. There's a strong chance it could be a Malaysian chicken on holidays.
Yeah. Yeah.
So soon after Bacon's death, there were reports of a semi-plucked chicken observed running in circles around Highgate ponds. And also seen in the lower branches of a nearby tree. Whenever anyone approached, it vanished into thin air. There are reports throughout the centuries, including during the Second World War, where air raid wardens in Highgate, who obviously were under no extra pressure that might cause a temporary psychosis based on previous folk stories, claimed they had seen it. There's another story of one who tried to capture it, and the chicken ran through a wall before he got to it. There's another story in Pondsgrove, and they heard what sounded like an invisible coach and horses. The sound stopped, and he saw a chicken, as though the chicken was also capable of doing impressions.
Was it crossing the road in front of the coach and horses?
Yes, indeed.
So it does the odd joke, too.
Well, what, you know, why did the chicken cross the road? To get to the other side.
Podcast over.
Yeah.
That's a joke.
Again, we have shut this podcast down so many times. Anyway, happy news, happy news, happy news. This news comes to you from Leeds in Yorkshire, where a gentleman, Sven Kirby, who adopted 2 pet geese during lockdown, has begun taking them to the local pub. The pub have insisted that the 2 birds, named Norbert and Beep Beep, when...
I insist that you take that again while trying to read it like a straight-faced BBC newsreader. And finally.
And finally. I'm struggling with their owner's name, to be honest. And finally, a gentleman from Leeds in Yorkshire named Sven Birkby. No, that's not his name. Named Sven Kirby. Been allowed. Has it? Look, I'm trying to both A, deliver this, and B, work out how the fuck the edit's going to work on this.
I'm going to mute myself.
Yeah.
I insist he gets through this. This may be the last episode that ever goes out if the internet gets shut down by President Biden / Trump, so, you know.
Our best news of the week comes from Leeds in Yorkshire, where a gentleman named Sven Kirby has adopted 2 geese named Norbert and Beep Beep. and he has been allowed to take them to his local pub on the proviso that Norbert and Beep Beep wear nappies at all times. When asked about it, Sven said, Sven, who lives on his own, too fucking right he does, having two nappyless geese wandering around his house. I know a goose is a strange pet, but it's something different that I've wanted for a while. I could have got a dog, but as I work full time, I didn't think that was very fair. Geese require much less attention, not when they've been on the lash in a pub for an evening, mate.
Yeah. Oh my god, Norbert and Beep Beep.
Yeah, just glorious. So our very best wishes to that wonderful threesome.
The best mismatch, I think, of audience and speaker is happened in 2013. And it happened at the WI in Parkham in Devon. And they booked a man to talk about pirates. And he turned up and he'd written a book about being kidnapped by Somalian pirates at gunpoint, and they demanded 1.6 million quid. And the WI were all dressed as pirates. I mean, it's the definition of a tough gig, because he's come with a big box of his books about his harrowing experience. And he says, Mr. Darch, Colin Darch, who wrote the book, he was held hostage for 47 days in 2008. They were more embarrassed than me, said Mr. Darch, 75. WI Treasurer Steph George, 54, said he was such a good sport, but we won't be dressing up again for a while. Mr. Darch from Appledore said they were a bit nonplussed, but it didn't bother me. They'd all made an effort. Most of them seemed to be wearing false moustaches and funny hats. It looked like a rehearsal for Pirates of Penzance. One lady even had a parrot on her shoulder. and he apparently did the signing and sold some books. So in the end, what I love about that is he's come along in all good faith to do it, and he's just, the room has misjudged him. And I love that. It's really nice to see the tables turned, because there's so many potentials for disaster in public speaking, but I think that one really comes out of left field and no one sees it coming.
Yeah, it's because of the eye patches.